The Iowa Arts Showcase is Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. April is showering us with a wonderful selection of brilliant arts and musical events. We'll catch up with a world-renowned pianist whose 15-city tour brings him to Iowa and Carnegie Hall. We'll hear about a prairie program celebrating all different kinds of art. We'll congratulate the Sioux City Symphony on 100 years of music making. We'll investigate the Anne Frank A History for Today exhibit. We'll welcome an America's Got Talent finalist back home. And we'll get the inside scoop on the musicians from Marlboro's upcoming Ames Town and Gown performance. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
We would welcome people to come and visit us in Vermont. We have 5 weekends of concerts between the middle of July and the middle of August. We hope they'll come to the concert in Ames and also listen to the programs that you will be broadcasting. So we welcome you and all your listeners to join us in Vermont and at the concert.
Marlboro Music School and Festival Administrator Frank Solomon. The radio program Frank was referring to is The Magic of Marlboro. We hope you'll join us for the last concert broadcast in the series. That's next Saturday, April 9th at 10 a.m. on Iowa Public Radio Classical. Every summer in Vermont, musicians gather to delve into the magic of chamber music. Since the early 50s, the Marlboro Music Festival has welcomed such esteemed performers as Rudolf Serkin, Pablo Casals, Aaron Copland, Marie Pariah, Jamie Laredo, and their current artistic director, Mitsuko Uchida. For 50 years, the musicians from Marlboro's touring program has brought outstanding concerts to audiences across the country. Frank Solomon, along with viola Samuel Rhodes, joined the Marlboro team in 1960. It was in 1961 that Frank started coordinating the touring aspect of musicians from Marlboro. Sam started as an 18- and 19-year-old violist at Marlboro. Within just a few years, he was asked to join the Juilliard String Quartet and faculty. He performed with the Juilliard Quartet for 44 years. Currently, he performs now as one of the seasoned musicians for Marlboro and also as a member of the Juilliard faculty. Sam and Frank talk about the musicians of Marlboro's April 12th Ames Town and Gown concert. Sam Rhodes.
The program starts with a Haydn quartet from the Opus 20s. Haydn was one of the most revolutionary of the classical composers. As he himself said, he was kind of stuck in this remote area, composing at the will of the Prince Esterhazy, and he was able to experiment any way that he wanted. And in the Opus 20s, that comes to the fore, that type of experimentation. There are all kinds of uneven phrase lengths. There are all kinds of interesting original things which other composers were not doing at that time. Also, the idea of the string quartet, instead of just almost like an orchestral thing with the first violin doing most of the work and everybody else accompanying, and kind of dance movements, almost like an entertainment piece, he made the string quartet a very serious genre. And the quartet that we're playing, for example, it starts with a cello solo, and that would have been unheard of. And he has places where in this quartet where the function of each instrument is traded off, instead of the usual normal function. Someone other than the first violin will play the melody. Someone other than the cello will play the bass. And the first violin and the cello might play some middle voices, always trading back and forth, almost like a baseball team throwing a ball around the field. Then one of the movements is operatic. It's almost like a scene from Orpheus in the second act, where Orpheus charms the demons with his beautiful singing. The last movement is a very involved contrapuntal device. It's a fugue with 4 subjects. And it's played as soft as possible until right near the very end, when it bursts out in the most joyous declaration that you can possibly imagine. So that's the Haydn. Then comes the lyrics suite, Berg, which is one of the classic works of the 20th century. It's a work which has a certain shape. The shape is starting from moderate in the sense of both musical moderation, the tempo's not too fast and not too slow, also in the sense of human temperament, very pleasant and loving, and it, from there on, it's a wedge on both sides. On the one side, it gets more and more hysterical, and on the other side, it gets more and more, at first very turbulent and then very depressed at the end, and depressed and resigned. And it was, when I studied this piece, we studied it as an abstract piece of music, like we do everything else. But it came out during, I think within the last 20 years or so, a diary was found in which it's really a description of a love affair that he had, which was with a married woman, which was doomed from the start. And he held it up in his mind as an idealized thing. And that's why the quotations from Tristan and Isolde are there.
I think it was unrequited, though, wasn't it?
Not necessarily.
No? I thought that's what I had read.
Not necessarily. No. But it's complicated. There's a lot more evidence on his side than on hers, let's say. But anyway...
And it was based on a 12-tone technique also.
Some of it is, and it's used in a very original and wonderful way, the 12-tone technique to unify the music. And the chord that's so characteristic of Tristan and Isolde, the half diminished seventh, is built into that, especially in the last movement. But also in other movements, you hear it at intermittent times come up. And then in the last movement, it's actually quoted verbatim, just for a few bars, and then it goes its own way. It's a very complicated piece emotionally and psychologically.
Very expressive, so I think...
Extremely expressive.
Yeah.
And it gets more so as the piece goes on. The last movement is one of the most beautiful movements you can imagine. And full of melodies and wonderful lines all the time. Although it's not the usual kind of line you can go at singing necessarily, but it's certainly there. You can hear lots of singing lines.
And tell us about the piano quintet.
The Dvorak Piano Quintet is one of the most popular works in the repertoire. Dvorak, there's the folk element, the Czech and the Slovakian folk element, and you can hear that in the melodies that he has. But it's not only that, it's the way, the atmosphere that goes with that. He draws a picture of a pastoral atmosphere or the inside of a, let's say, of an inn where people are having a wonderful time drinking and talking, or many other things are, it could be nature, it could be social. That all goes with it. And the imagination of the accompanying figures and all the parts of the music that go along with the melody are what makes it so beautiful. And that atmosphere, plus a tremendous amount of variety in first movement that starts out very thoughtful but becomes very brilliant at time and ends with a cascade of brilliance. A slow movement that starts very melancholy but has different parts that are contrasted with it, including a very fast middle section. And then it goes back to the first section, which is more melancholy. Then a really rousing scherzo with a thoughtful trio, and a very much dance-like finale, which you can actually see the people dancing and having a good time in it.
I think it's hard to stay in your seats.
Yes, exactly.
You know, you feel like getting up and dancing. So all of you in Iowa also have a strong connection to Dvorak, so we expect lots of Iowans to show up in Ames to hear the Dvorak Quintet, if nothing else.
Two movers and shakers from Musicians of Marlboro. Sam Rhodes, one of their seasoned touring violists, and longtime administrator Frank Solomon. The musicians of Marlboro will be performing their 50th anniversary concert tour, which includes the Ames Town & Gown Concert Series at Ames City Auditorium on April 12th at 7:30 p.m. For more details and tickets, please see amestownandgown.org. Tickets will also be available at the door. Just ahead, we'll take a peek at the Voices of the Prairie concert infused with art and poetry. We'll applaud the Sioux City Symphony on 100 years of music making. We'll pause to remember the courageous young woman, Anne Frank, her family, and the countless others who lost their lives in the Holocaust. We'll congratulate one of Iowa's own who made her mark on America's Got Talent. And we'll hear about Jeremy Denk's upcoming jazz and ragtime-infused civic music program on April 15th. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. World-renowned pianist Jeremy Denk is a modern-day Renaissance man. He was a Marlboro participant for 6 summers, starting in 1996 when he was in his 20s. He also participated in 4 Musicians for Marlboro tours. He started piano when he was 5 or 6 and studied at Oberlin, Indiana University, and Juilliard.
I guess I ended up at Oberlin because I had a lot of interests along with the piano. So I went to Oberlin with a double degree in piano and chemistry. I also went to college a little early, so I was still trying to figure out what I was going to do. And then when I was at Oberlin, I figured out that the piano was going to be my life. Then I had some other decisions from there. And I like to play a lot of different music, and I like to draw connections between different kinds of music. I guess that's partly what drew me to Oberlin, you know, sort of experimental aspect of music making, and the concert is kind of a happening. You know, I ended up going to Bloomington, Indiana to study with an amazing Hungarian guru of the piano named George Sebok. And I wrote a big article about him basically in The New Yorker about my lessons with him and how Europe landed on me there and in a sense changed my entire idea of what music was for and what it was about. He was an important figure, and he showed me, you know, what Mozart was about. He showed me what Bach was about, and he showed me many things about the language of different composers and what they had to say and why they were saying it, I guess. So he's one of my most important influences. And then I went to New York to sort of try to make a career, and over a course of a decade or two, built myself into a far too busy state of affairs, I guess.
Well, you also have a blog that you write, and apparently was selected by the Library of Congress for their web archives. That's amazing.
It is quite amazing, and I still can't quite wrap my head around that one, but you know, I guess they're trying to preserve some of the earlier blog, you know, with this whole ephemeral internet phenomenon that happened. And I was writing fairly regularly for about 6 or 7 years for no money, for my own pleasure, just about music and the things that happened to me on tour and the things in music that interested me. You know, I think back on that time, I don't know where I found the time, but I loved sort of getting down my thoughts about music in as irreverent or as unusual a way as I could so that they would communicate to more people, I guess. Read the blog. There's lots of archives. There's my ancient interview with Sarah Palin about Beethoven, which was a very popular one back in the day. And the New Yorker article, I think, is online. And I don't know, that was a great privilege for me to write about my teacher because he showed me about music in a way. And I wanted to talk about the miracle of the way that he taught and explored music with his students.
And you've also written a libretto to a comic opera.
Yeah, you know, that was a bit of a lark that turned into something more involved than I would have ever imagined. But I basically took a famous book about Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven for us musicians, and it's called The Classical Style. And it's about this miracle of style between 1770 and 1820, these three composers. And they sort of evolved a language, you know, that could express all these things about human existence that hadn't been expressible in music quite that way before. It's a famous book. It's a pretty wonky book, and we decided to turn this book of this musicological book into almost a vaudeville about classical music. And that was a great deal of fun, and it was an attempt to sort of make a theory lesson come to life, you know, in a way that hopefully many people could associate with. And it begins with Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven basically in a retirement home, grousing about how things aren't the way they used to be. And so a lot of the opera is about classical music and its quality of being stuck in the past. And how do we deal with that?
And who did you collaborate on with that?
Wonderful Stephen Stuckey wrote the music for the opera. Unfortunately, he just passed away. So it's a very bittersweet memory for me, but he wrote the most beautiful, especially maybe the ending. He wrote a very nostalgic ending for the ending of the classical style, in the sense of all human achievement passing on. He also had a great sense of humor for the sillier parts of the opera.
You are on tour right now. You're doing like a 15-city tour?
More or less, yeah. I think I haven't counted, but something like that.
The New York Times has said that you are someone you want to hear no matter what he performs. So tell us what you're going to be performing in Iowa and also at Carnegie Hall.
Well, the first half has a wonderful masterpiece of Bach, and then it has this long and very wild, what I call an iPod shuffle about syncopation. And it sort of uses the ragtime as a point of departure, and then it ventures to European composers' homages to the ragtime, and other great syncopated music throughout history, including as far back as William Byrd, which is more or less 1590, right, something like that, and an incredible piece of his that ends almost with a ragtime frenzy, and then it begins with Joplin, and it has a great American composer named Conlon Nancarrow, who wrote this kind of deconstructed jazz bass etude, and then it ends with also an amazing lampoon of Wagner by a famous stride pianist named Donald Lambert. So there's a lot of different music, and it's all about sort of the wit and joy of syncopation and dislocation, choking, rhythmic play.
Well, I hate to admit, but I had never heard of Colin Nankauer and Donald Lambert.
Uh-huh.
I had not heard of them.
Well, I didn't really know Donald Lambert that well, but I guess in the stride piano world, it's pretty important, and I heard this piece, and it made me smile, and I love things that make me smile. And it's a great deal of virtuoso piano fun.
Well, what's also nice in this is you've mentioned that you start out with Bach and you have Byrd in here, but you also have some real favorites that everybody loves, like the Beethoven Piano Sonata number 14 and the Schubert work. You have some real classical favorites, and then you have this potpourri of other things that are really incredible that I think people are just going to love.
Yeah, I think it will be a great deal of fun, and I think piano recitals should be fun, among other things.
So, is this T for Two, is that by Art Tatum?
It's Art Tatum, yeah.
So, you have a little jazz thrown in here, too?
Oh, the Donald Lambert's very much jazz, too. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of Joplin. I mean, there's all kinds of... Yeah, but it's about the idea that syncopation passes across, you know, many centuries of human music, you know? And it belongs to classical music as well as jazz, and it's an important force, and it's one of the great things the composers use to give surprise.
All of these works are so approachable that audience members are going to love them, but if you happen to look at a program and just see the works of Hindemith or you see Ives or something, you might immediately think, oh, this is going to be very avant-garde.
It's not going to be, for the most part. The Hindemith is a lark. It's like 2 minutes long, and it's just like a player piano gone crazy. The Nancarrow is a great deal of fun. And the Bolcom, of course, is one of the most beloved pieces in all of the piano repertoire. It's gorgeous, and it's the kind of more reflective kind of rag, nostalgic and sad. And it's one of his most perfect pieces, actually.
When you're going to put a program together, how do you decide what you're going to play and how you're going to approach it?
You know, it just takes time to think about pieces that interest me and then put together combinations of things that interest me. So that's what I do. There's certain pieces that you're fascinated by, certain combinations that you think that the audience won't expect, but it will be interesting for them.
Well, now, I've never interviewed a genius before, so tell us about this award that you won.
Well, it's a great honor, you know, the MacArthur Grant, and, you know, it's a secret nominating process, and people get recommended, and then they sort of ask about you all over the world, and finally they call you out of the blue and give you this sum of money, and no strings attached, just to help you do what you do. So my friend always, when we go out to dinner, he says, "What genius picked this place now?" So there's lots of jokes that your friends make when you get that. Award, which is important.
And you also won the Avery Fisher Prize in 2014.
Yeah, Avery Fisher Prize, which is a great honor. I share with lots of amazing colleagues. Completely overwhelming. Yeah, no, I feel very lucky to have received all these accolades. And now I just try to practice to deserve them.
So what do you feel is your purpose with your talent and your art? What do you want to do with it, or where do you want to go with it?
Well, you know, on the one hand, you just want to play as well as you can and make music as well as you can. And then in other respects, you know, I want to communicate about classical music, obviously this music that I love, and bring it closer to, you know, the world at large, make it more accessible. So I think that's what my writing is about, and that's what some of these interesting combinations of pieces are about, just trying to, not exactly evangelizing, but for me, classical music isn't in any way abstruse or arcane or, you know, even that nerdy. It's just music. And how can you frame it so that people feel that? The visceral part of classical music, the danceable part of classical music, the joking part of classical music, the, you know, emotional catharsis part too, of course.
Pianist Jeremy Denk. Jeremy will perform his atypical recital on Friday, April 15th at 7:30 p.m. in Chaslow Auditorium in Des Moines as part of the Civic Music Association concert series. To get more details and tickets, please see their website at civicmusic.org. Tickets will also be available at the door. Don't go away. We'll see how the Sioux City Symphony commemorates a monumental anniversary. We'll learn about a six-year collaboration between the UNI Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education and the Grout Museum. We'll marvel at the tenacity of one young Iowan to follow her musical dreams. And we'll hear about the Nova Singer's 30-year history of vocal excellence. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Not all vocal ensembles last, but thanks to the creative drive and talents of Laura Lane, founder and music director of the 21-voice professional choir Nova Singers, they have survived and flourished for 30 years. This spring, Nova Singers will commemorate their anniversary with a world premiere and a Midwest collaboration of music, art, and poetry called Voices of the Prairie.
It's a celebration of everybody that makes art of different kinds in the Midwest, and in order to do that, I asked my colleague here at Knox College, would she like to come on board and do something with us? And she said, yes. Lynette Lombard is an amazing painter who teaches here at Knox College, and she's a member of this group called the Midwest Paint Group. And what they do is it's a group of painters who live in the American Midwest, and they start from landscapes. So they paint looking at landscape and then build out from there into what is called post-abstract figuration. I don't really know exactly what that means, but I know that their paintings are beautiful and that you can tell that they're landscapes. So that idea really appealed to Lynette, the idea of collaborating with us to create something that is more than a concert. It's a concert art exhibit, so it's a big event for us to collaborate with them. They have painted brand new paintings. So in Galesburg, we're doing our concert at Kresge Recital Hall. The artworks will be right outside of the hall in the lobby, all around where people will be coming in. In the Quad Cities, we're actually doing our concert, and this is also something we've never done before. We're really excited about it. We're doing the concert in the lobby of the Figge Art Museum. So on Sunday, April 10th, the paintings of the Midwest Paint Group will be all around us on easels around the lobby, the outer edge of the lobby. The audience will be seated in the middle. We'll sing our concert so they can come early and look at the paintings. And the Figge Art Museum is going to make a very special brochure highlighting works in their collection that will be up at this time that connect with the poetry of the songs that we're doing. So if when somebody arrives at the concert, you could come early and walk around and look at the paintings having to do with subjects that are in the concert itself, in addition to the landscapes by the Midwest Paint Group that were made for this event. So that's kind of cool. And then they can stay as long as they like on that Sunday afternoon and evening. There's so much collaboration going on behind the scenes to make all of this work. There's the Midwest Paint Group. There's the Figge Art Museum. There's the commission of the new work by Abby Bettinas and all the work that takes behind the scenes. There will be art. There will be food. There will be just the guest composers. There's so much going on. It's very exciting.
Tell us about the Voices of the Prairie concert itself, and you've commissioned a world premiere, and so many neat things are happening. So tell us about it.
I went looking for choral pieces that would be settings by local poets, and I found several settings by Carl Sandburg. And then I went looking for music by local composers, and I found Galesburg composer Bruce Pollet, Chicago composer Ed Davis, who went to Knox and studied in Galesburg here at Knox College with Bruce Pollet, and then we commissioned Minneapolis composer Abby Bettinas to write a new work just for us, and we're giving the world premiere of her new piece at this concert. So she went looking, studying Carl Sandburg's poetry, and she chose two Sandburg poems, one of which she wrote earlier, and we're doing that one at this concert, At a Window. It's very beautiful. The new one is called Harvest Moon. Fits in perfectly with the whole theme. It's about a person looking at the moon, longing for love, and finding love. It's very, very beautiful. And we are just thrilled that Abby Bettinas was, first of all, what an honor that this world-famous composer agreed to write a piece for us for our 30th anniversary and agreed to look at Carl Sandburg, who was born in Galesburg and lived in the Midwest and was so in love with the Midwest prairie that he wrote so many poems about it. So all of this is coming together. Abby is from Minneapolis, St. Paul. She's also very famous. She's probably the most famous choral composer under the age of 40 right now in the world today. And so, as I mentioned, it's an honor that she chose to accept a commission from us and to write this new piece for us, and we're absolutely thrilled. She's going to be coming to the concerts that weekend so that she can attend the premiere. In fact, I think all the composers are going to be present at the concerts. So that's really exciting.
So how can folks get more information and tickets?
You can buy tickets by emailing the Nova Singers manager, and we are recommending to everybody that they pre-purchase their tickets, especially in the Figge Art Museum. There is some limited seating. And you can also buy tickets on the website. It's novasingers.com, or you can email nova@knox.edu.
Founder and music director of Nova Singers, Laura Lane. The Knox College Nova Singer Concert starts at 7:30 p.m. on the 9th, and the Figge Art Museum program starts at 4 p.m. on the 10th. Just ahead, the UNI Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education and the Grout Museum join forces to present two exhibits, Iowa's Ties to the Holocaust and Anne Frank, A History for Today. A Waterloo native has received critical acclaim for her country and blues vocal stylings, and the Sioux City Symphony celebrates with a performance of Beethoven's Ninth. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
I think it's a wonderful thing that an orchestra in the northwest pocket of Iowa in the middle of the United States has been able to achieve such great and wonderful things. And I continue to be honored to be a part of this organization and to be a part of the musical life here in Sioux City. But I think it's greater than that. I think now is the time when in the orchestra world, things are changing, and we're still trying to find our footing where it comes to new music being written today and the format and how we can attract new audiences and how we can preserve our great base of support. And I really feel that what's going on in Sioux City something that people really need to look at, because there's a community that countlessly supports this orchestra and is significantly invested in what is going on here. And for some people, this is sort of what they call the flyover country. But I'll tell you, some amazing things happen here that I've not been able to experience in some other major cities around the world. And that's really special. For an orchestra here to be at the sort of forefront of what's going on and being able to give pretty regular world premieres of works being written today by young composers, even some young American composers, which we really have a passion for here, to be stretching the boundaries of that performance and concert presentation, of telling people that it doesn't have to be this stuffy world where you have to study music for 50, 60, 70 years before you can come and understand a Mozart symphony. It needs to be stopped, all of that stuff, because it doesn't get us anywhere, because that's also not the purpose of what we do. The music has to live, and it has to live in different people from different experiences and different backgrounds. And if we're able to do that, and we're able to continue the life and the direction and the future of this great art that we're a part of, that's all we can do. And if there's anything to celebrate this season, that's what we look at, that we're part of that, and that we're a significant push to the future. And we can look back on this hopefully in the next 100 years and say, wow, look where we were at that point. Who knows what the future looks like, but I'm certainly proud of the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra and their position in that development and that progress. It's an exciting time, and it really has been a fantastic year.
Music director and conductor of the Sioux City Symphony, Ryan Haskins. Ryan's 7 years with the orchestra makes him the sixth music director in 100 years with the orchestra. The organization was founded in 1915 as a community symphony. They presented their first concert in February of the following year. In 2000, they started calling the restored Orpheum Theater their new home. The symphony has an amazing concert planned for April.
Well, you can't really celebrate a huge anniversary such as the 100th, I think, without the great Beethoven 9th Symphony. And so we've selected that to sort of end the formal portion of our season this year. I think what this symphony symbolizes and what it's been able to achieve is something great. And I think that's something that we can celebrate as music lovers, not just classical music lovers, but lovers of live performance and lovers of music in general, that there's a reason why things stick around. There's a reason why music has the influence to affect us and affect so many of us in different ways. There's something to be said about that, and maybe still be past words. You know, it's one of those moments where you're really not sure how it all works, but it does. The symphony, of course, throughout its history, has had significant performances, you know, world occasions that sort of surround this work, and the symbol of peace just sort of runs through it, not only to the poem that, of course, the last movement highlights, but just its power and the significance of what this symphony is for us as human beings. And that's really, I think, the greatest effect that Beethoven has on us, that power, that ability to be able to touch each of us in so many different ways hundreds of years later, and I know that it'll continue. And of course, then we start an entire program with Copland. So we start with the Fanfare for the Common Man, and then the great narrated work for orchestra, Lincoln Portrait. And we're welcoming a great television star from ABC, Maya Stojan, to narrate that. So it'll be a wonderful program that sort of finds us at a wonderful place in the year, and certainly in the symphony's history.
And your soloists that you're bringing back are quite phenomenal. And in fact, one of them has Iowa connections as well. So just tell us briefly about the four soloists.
The soprano, Amanda Hall, actually is a wonderful singer out of the D.C. area. She'll be with us. Just a beautiful, beautiful, strong soprano voice that, you know, needs to carry over such a thick orchestration. The mezzo is a wonderful young singer that's sort of at the beginnings of her career, won the Met competition a few years ago, Margaret Mezzacapa. Great, great voice that will pair lovely with Amanda's. The tenor is the Iowa connection, and in fact, even more clear, the Sioux City connection. John Osborne, who frequents, you know, the world stages, whether it's Covent Garden or whether it's the Met in New York or Chicago or wherever. He has an extensive performance schedule throughout the world, and a wonderful, wonderful tenor. It will be really fantastic to welcome him back. And then the baritone, a great, great person, good friend, is Sanford Sylvan, who's, of course, just an amazing ability to bring to the front true passion, and it's one of those voices that you, the first word out of his mouth, you sort of feel down to your toes. You know, he's famous for not only his Bach passions, but equally, you know, several premieres of John Adams, Nixon in China, and such. So it's quite a cast of vocalists, of singers, and it's going to be a really wonderful addition to the whole operation, and not even to mention the some close to 300 singers behind the orchestras in the chorus. So it's going to be a very powerful evening.
I was going to ask you about the choirs that were going to be involved and how you were going to squeeze everybody on stage.
We're still trying to figure that out. if I had the power to build a whole other stage, I would. You know, throughout these last couple of months, I've had the opportunity to have some great chorus masters preparing choirs, and I myself have had the opportunity to go out to some of these cities around Sioux City and work with these choirs, and it's a really great thing, you know, because we have a variety of different voices. We have some university college choirs, and we also have some more sort of amateur community choirs that are very, very good. As you probably know, in Iowa, the singing is really fantastic. I've always been impressed with that. And so the combination of both of this sort of experience and the newness and the excitement for a person who's performing their very first Beethoven 9, that combined with everything else, it's just been a wonderful experience to work with them, and really looking forward to welcoming them all to Sioux City.
And having the opportunity to perform with a symphony orchestra, I think that could be really thrilling as well.
You know, I conduct all over, and when I come to Sioux City and I come to Iowa, I meet some just really fantastic people who are genuine, and genuine not just within life, but genuine within music. And, you know, you can't get more direct than that. It's something that just sort of flows out from these people, and it's a beautiful thing. And I think I need to be better personally about remembering that, because it's so easy to take for granted that this just lives here, and it's a really special thing to be able to be a part of. You know, I was just working with a choir in Estherville, and it's a community college choir that we've worked with before, which has a great director, but it's a small group. And I went out, and I have kids standing there in, you know, baseball uniforms, and kids with a military backpack. And I mean, and some people, I think, would look at that and say, oh, well, you know, that's nice, but what kind of performance? You know, to me, those are the really important parts where we, especially in a work like Beethoven 9, where we can celebrate all of these people being able to be part of such an important performance, not just because it's a part of our 100th anniversary, because we get to perform it again, or because it'll be taped for rebroadcast on public television, but just because it's doing what it's supposed to do, and it, the intention of what Beethoven had back when he wrote it, it is exactly there, and that is to be able to share this, to have people affected and changed, and go away from having this experience, whether you're in the audience, the orchestra, or the choir, to be able to be affected by this greatly powerful and passionate music. So it's just a joy to be able to prepare, and it makes me look forward to the performance even more so.
So how can folks get tickets to this Ode to Joy April 16th concert?
Well, they can always check us out on the internet at siouxcitysymphony.org. They can follow our Facebook pages and our Twitter pages. They can also call us directly at 712-277-2111.
Music director and conductor of the Sioux City Symphony, Ryan Haskins. Congratulations to the Sioux City Symphony for 100 years of great performances for music lovers across the Midwest. Just ahead, the Gallagher Blue Dorn welcomes home in concert the 2014 America's Got Talent second place finalist, Emily West. And history provides valuable lessons. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
Schlaf wieder ruhiger. I have to say that 6 years ago, when the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education was first established, I never thought that in 2016 there'd be such a plentiful daily supply of news stories, large international events that have the same elements that are the hallmark of the Holocaust. And so it's a reminder that the Holocaust is never history, but something that really connects us from that generation to the challenges of this generation today.
The director of UNI's Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education, Dr. Stephen Gaze.
This is the sixth year of a collaboration between the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education and the Grout Museum District. Each spring, we bring a traveling exhibit to the Grout dealing with the Holocaust or some other genocide or human rights issue. And this year promises to be perhaps our most popular exhibit because we're bringing Anne Frank, a History for Today exhibit from the Anne Frank Center in New York. This is an exhibit that people of all ages can learn a lot from and be inspired by.
Now, the Grout has also connected this exhibit with ties to the Holocaust in Iowa. Tell us about that connection.
Yeah, this was an initiative of the Grout Museum's new curator for exhibits, Erin Dawson, and she's putting together a collection of artifacts and audio and video testimonies of Iowans with a connection to the Holocaust, either Holocaust survivors and their descendants, or Iowa GIs who were present at the liberation of the camps in the spring of 1945, or other World War II veterans who were in one way or another indirectly connected with the events of the Holocaust. I know that she's collecting material from Iowans all over the state, and I think this is going to be very interesting complement to the Anne Frank exhibit to show that these events were really connected to Iowa and Iowans.
The Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education will not only be collaborating with the Grout Museum, but is also teaming up with the Jewish Federation of the Quad Cities.
The director of outreach and exhibits from the Anne Frank Center in New York, Hillary Stiepelman, will be coming to our area to conduct a workshop for teachers on Wednesday, April 6th. And I might add that there are still a few openings left in that workshop, so any teachers who want to get into the workshop, there are still a few places. She'll also do a talk for students at UNI. And then we're bringing another speaker. This is the documentary filmmaker Paula Faust, who just released a new documentary called No Asylum. And the film is based on recently discovered letters written by Anne Frank's father, Otto Frank, which show that as early as 1938, and then again more desperately in 1941, he was writing to a friend of his in the United States, trying to get help to get the family out of Nazi-occupied Holland and to safety in the United States. And it's an entirely different perspective on the Anne Frank family saga, you know, whom we normally think of as having spent more than 2 years in hiding. But this was a family that was really trying to get out of Europe, and their inability to do that, despite the fact that her father had personal connections in the United States, their inability to do that is sort of an emblem of the entire situation of refugees from Nazi-occupied Europe. And obviously, there are echoes of that event in much of what is happening today with the worldwide refugee crisis. So it's a very, very different look at the story of the Anne Frank family, and Paula Faust will be introducing and screening that film, No Asylum, on Thursday, April 21st at 7 o'clock in Sabin Hall 2. That's the auditorium on the UNI campus.
You also, in conjunction with all of these things, are going to be bringing in someone else for a special presentation for your Holocaust Remembrance Ceremony. Tell us about that.
This will be our 10th annual Holocaust Remembrance Ceremony in the Cedar Valley, and it will take place at the Grout Museum on Wednesday, May 4th. And the doors to the museum will be open at 5, and people are welcome to come and see the Anne Frank exhibit, as well as the Iowa's Ties to the Holocaust exhibit, at no charge that evening. The ceremony will beginning at 7 o'clock, and the museum will remain open until 9. We'll have a lot of our usual events. We are going to have a guest speaker this year, and it's a person with a very interesting family history. The speaker is Bev Ellis, who is a resident of Des Moines, whose parents were Holocaust survivors, and she herself was born in a displaced persons camp. These camps were set up all throughout Germany following the end of the war. There were some in Italy as well, because so many survivors simply had no place to go. They couldn't return to their home countries. They had no place to go immediately. And so many, many children were born in these DP camps. There's a lot more to the story of Bev Ellis and her family. Her older brother was given a camera by a GI, I think, and he took a lot of photos of the DP camp that really are a treasure for knowing about daily life in a German DP camp for Holocaust survivors. So she'll talk a little bit about her personal life and about her reflections on the Holocaust in our world today.
And you also are going to have a program in the Quad Cities?
Yes. Technically speaking, the very first showing of the film, No Asylum in the Midwest, will take place under the auspices of the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education, but in cooperation with the Jewish Federation of the Quad Cities. So we'll be screening the film on Wednesday evening, April 20th, at the Figge Museum of Art in downtown Davenport. But then the very next night, we'll show it for the second time in the Midwest here on the UNI campus.
So, Stephen, how can folks get more information about these events at the Grout and also this special remembrance ceremony and your film screening as well?
Well, there are several ways to do it. You can go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/UNICHGE. You can go to the Grout Museum's website, gmdistrict.org. And for the screening of No Asylum, the film produced and directed by Paula Faust, you can go to the UNI calendar as well.
The director of UNI's Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education, Dr. Stephen Gaze. To find out more details on the No Asylum documentary presentation and the Jewish Federation of the Quad Cities Holocaust Remembrance Ceremonies and their guest speaker, please see their website at jfqc.org. Don't go away. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. The Rolling Stone calls her a powerhouse vocalist. Iowans call her beautiful, innovative, talented, and say, "We saw her first."
I wouldn't be where I am today without the help of my hometown in Waterloo in Cedar Falls. I have had such support with Sturgis Falls, and I had my first really big show at the Electric Park Ballroom at the Policeman's Ball. My dad is Steve Nemers. He was a part of the Waterloo Police Department. I got a lot of my encouragement through the, you know, just the help of Waterloo and Cedar Falls people. And I started really young, too, so it was really great to have that encouragement when I was such a young girl, because then it just built me up and it made me think that I could do anything, like moving to Nashville so young. So I really just thank everyone that, you know, has ever encouraged me to go this far and, you know, believe in myself.
Iowa's own Emily West. In 2014, singer Emily West charmed TV viewers as a second-place finalist in America's Got Talent. Just 1 year later, she released her first album called All of You. Currently, she's been touring on the road with Jay Leno. Emily graduated from Waterloo West. She set out to be a country singer and headed to Nashville. As she herself will admit, she was young and naive, didn't have any plans, wanted to write songs, and thought anything was possible. Since then, with a lot of hard work, risk-taking, and belief in God, she has transformed her career.
I've been really fortunate to have a lot of different styles to my voice. And, you know, I cut my teeth on people like Patsy Cline and Barbara Streisand and Judy Garland. And it never really found a home, but I did know that I could sing. It just, I couldn't really be boxed in by a genre. And that's been, you know, kind of a difficult thing because in 2003, I was signed to a recording contract at Capitol Records. It was a country record deal. And, you know, I really tried to really fit the mold of what country music radio was doing. And I kind of lost myself because I tried so hard to be this country singer. And authentically, I really think that I just want to sing good songs. So when I got dropped from my record deal, I went through this really big depression. And I had to kind of go, well, what do I want to sing? And it just, I moved to New York, and I had, again, I was fearless. I think it was, you know, a complete God thing where, because I wasn't as positive as I was when I moved to Nashville. I was fearless, though, and I think that was just the act of God just, you know, giving me the strength and the faith to kind of do a different thing. And with that, I became fearless again and found a new kind of genre that I wanted to sing, which is just beautiful cinematic songs that I believe in. So that's been my journey with growing as an artist and as a human.
So how did you get involved with America's Got Talent?
I was living outside of New York, and I just sold my car. I was so scared, and I didn't know where I was going, so I just posted this really depressing Facebook status. I'm like going, what am I doing here? I left my dog and my friends. I miss home. And someone from America's Got Talent saw the post. And she reached out to me and she said, look, I don't know if you're into reality TV shows, but you should try out. And I put my videotape in because I remember what Cyndi Lauper told me, never be afraid. And I just believed that, you know, I was really scared because my story wasn't like the typical, hey, this is the first time for me. I was already signed to a record deal, and I was really afraid. But, you know, I just went out there, and I auditioned. I was terrified. I wore that black and red dress that my friend made me and went out there in front of the world, and I auditioned. It was a lot, but I took it on, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, congratulations on becoming the second place winner. I think that was just as good as first place because you obviously are taking off now. And you just last summer released your debut album. Tell us about that.
It's been so wonderful. I really do think that, you know, it's all a gift. And I released it on Sony Masterworks, an amazing label in New York. And they just allowed me to do what it is that I do. And so I made it with my friend Dustin Branson in his 2-bedroom house. He played everything on it, and we made this record in a matter of, I think, like 2 months or something, and a lot of the songs were covers from the show, and I'm currently in the middle of making my second record now, which is really exciting because it's going to be a little bit more who I am as an artist and who I want to be. But yeah, it has Cyndi Lauper singing with me on True Colors, which is amazing, and has 4 original songs that I wrote with my friend K.S. Rhodes. And I've got the opportunity to go on my one-woman show tour, and I sing a lot of my originals at my concert. So, you know, it's been all a gift. It's just wonderful.
Now, you have learned on this process just to be yourself. So why is that so important?
still learning every day how to be myself. My mom is a very wise woman, and she, you know, she's such an encourager to me. And she said, "Emily, you know, all you need to do is be yourself." And I said, "Yeah, I know, but which one?" You know, there's so many different personalities that I have. I don't have personality disorder, I don't think, but I do think that the thing that makes you great is usually the vulnerable things that we're afraid to show. And I'm learning to let go of that and to embrace the vulnerability side of me and who I am and the little girl part of me, because once you start hiding that, the truth stops coming out. And the truth is what everyone wants. That's being authentic, and I'm learning every day to walk in truth and to never hide from what is actually real and true.
Well, you're going to be in Cedar Falls at UNI's Gallagher Blue Dorn, and tell us what you're going to be performing when you come back to the state.
Oh, well, you know, we got to give them some America's Got Talent songs. A lot of people are fans of Chandelier, which I'm excited to sing, and Nice and White Satin is probably going to make an appearance. But, you know, a lot of my originals are going to be showing up as well, which I'm excited about. I don't want to give away too much, but it's going to be probably one of the most, I mean, I'm so terrified. I mean, I'm going back to my home. I'm terrified in the most beautiful way, but you have to know that I am so incredibly blessed and excited to have my hometown embrace me like this. And oh, I am so thankful, but I'm so scared because these are my people. And they have watched me grow up, and, you know, it's like my family. Anyway, I'm just so super excited and pumped and terrified. But I think when I'm terrified, it's usually the best show, because I tend to put everything I have in it. And I hope that everyone enjoys it. And I can't tell you how humbling it is to come back to where I was born and raised and, you know, given such a great life to get to perform for the people that, you know, believed in me first is just so beautiful and humbling, and I'm so excited. It's such a gift. I'm really looking forward to it, and we're going to have a party. It's going to be great. It's going to be a great night.
Iowa's own Emily West. Emily's concert kicks off at 7:30 on Friday night, April 29th at UNI's Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. Tickets and more info are available at gbpac.com. And starting this weekend is Iowa Public Radio's Arias in April broadcast series, Saturday evenings at 8 and Sunday nights at 11 through the month of April. Tonight's presentation features the Des Moines Metro Opera's production of Mozart's Abduction from the Seraglio. For more details, see our website at iowapublicradio.org. And while you're there, you can also make your tax-deductible pledge. Today's Iowa Arts Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Frank Solomon, Samuel Rhodes, Jeremy Dank, Laura Lane, Ryan Haskins, Stephen Gaze, and Emily West. To hear more from all the guest interviews on today's Iowa Arts Showcase, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Arts Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner and Phil Moss. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.